I... She stopped a minute to wipe the tears off her cheeks. It's like there's something doesn't want me to get a boy raised, Clara said, her voice cracking. July lay awake all night, remembering how it felt to have her take his hand. Her fingers had twined for a moment in his before she let go. It had seemed she needed him, else she wouldn't have squeezed so. It made him so excited that he couldn't sleep, and yet when he went back upstairs in the morning and stepped into the sick room, Clara was distant, though it was a fine sunny day and the baby's fever was down. His breath still rattled, but he was asleep. I could bring you up some coffee, July said. No, thanks. I know my way to the kitchen well enough, she said, standing up. This time she neither hugged him nor took his hand. She walked past him without a look. All he could do was follow her downstairs. Lorena and the girls had already made breakfast, and Cholo came in to eat. July didn't feel hungry. The fact that Clara was displeased took his appetite away. He tried to think why she might be displeased, but could come up with no reasons. He sat numbly through breakfast and went out the door, feeling it would be hard to get his mind on work. He needed to repair the wheel of the big wagon, which had cracked somehow. Before he could even get the wheel off, he saw Clara coming toward the tool shed. Though it was sunny, it was also very cold. Her breath made little clouds. July was afraid the baby might have taken a turn for the worse, but that was not it. Clara was very angry. "You'd do better to talk to me when I'm mad," she said, with no preamble. There were points of red in her cheeks. "I'm no talker, I guess," July said. "You're not much of anything, but you could be," she said. "I know you're smart, because Martin is, and he didn't get it all from your poor wife. But a fence post is more useful generally than you are." July took it as a criticism of his work, which he felt he had done scrupulously. "I've nearly got this wheel fixed," he said. "July, I'm not talking about chores," she said. "I'm talking about me. I sat there all night in that room with your baby. Where were you?" July had been thinking that he probably should have offered to sit with her. Of course, now it was too late. He wanted to explain that he was too shy just to come into a room where she was, particularly a bedroom, unless she asked him. Even coming into the kitchen, if she was alone, was not something he did casually, but he didn't know how to explain all the cautions she prompted in him. "I wish now I had," he said. Clara's eyes were flashing. "I told you how sickness frightens me," she said. "The only times I've ever wished I could die is when I had to sit and watch a child suffer." She was twisting one hand in the other. July, seeing that she was shivering, took off his coat and held it out to her, but Clara ignored the offer. "I sit there alone," she said. "I don't want the girls to be there because I don't want them to get death too much in their minds. I sit there and I think. I'm alone, and I can't help this child. If it wants to die, I can't stop it. I can love it until I bleed, and it won't stop it. I hope it won't die. I hope it can grow up and have its time. I know how I'll feel if it does die, how long it'll take me to care if I draw a breath, much less about cooking and the girls and all the things that you have to do if you're alive." Clara paused. In the lots, a sorrel stallion whinnied. He was her favorite, but this day she appeared not to hear him. "I know. If I lose one more child, I'll never care again," she said. "I won't. Nothing will make any difference to me again if I lose one more. It'll ruin me. It'll ruin my girls. I'll never buy another horse, or cook another meal, or take another man. I'll starve, or else I'll go crazy and welcome it. Or I'll kill the doctor for not coming, or you for not sitting with me, or something. If you want to marry me, why don't you come and sit?" July realized then that he had managed to do a terrible thing, though all he had done was go to his room in the ordinary way. It startled him to hear Clara say she could kill him over such a thing as that. But he knew from her look that it wasn't just talk. "Would you ever marry me?" he asked. "You never said." "No, and I'm not about to say now," Clara said. "Ask me in a year."
"Why in a year?"
"Because you deserve to suffer for a year," Clara said. "I suffered a year's work just last night, and I guess you were lying at your ease dreaming of our wedding night." July had no reply. He had never known a woman who spoke so boldly. He looked at her through the fog of her breath, wishing that she would at least take the coat. The cold made goosebumps on her wrists. "I thought you were a sheriff once," Clara said. The stallion whinnied again, and still watching July, she waved at the horse. He had the eyes of a sweet but bewildered boy in the body of a sturdy man. She wanted the sturdiness close to her, but was irritated by the bewilderment. "Oh, I was a sheriff," he said.
"Didn't you ever give orders then?" she said.
"Well, I told Roscoe when to clean the jail," July said. "It ain't much, but it's more than we hear from you around here," Clara said. "Try telling me when to clean something, just for practice, once in a while. At least I'd get to hear a sound out of your throat." Again, she refused the coat, though it was clear to him that she was in a somewhat better temper. She went over and rubbed the stallion's neck for 10 minutes before going back to the house. Then the other man, Dish Boget, had to come, bringing the news that Augustus McCrae was dead. He had picked his way along the Platte River in a January blizzard. Both his horses were exhausted, but Dish himself seemed no worse for wear. He treated blizzards as a matter-of-fact occurrence. It seemed to July that Clara took an instant liking to Dish Boget, and he couldn't help feeling resentful, although he soon perceived that Dish had come to court Lorena, not Clara. Lorena had hardly spoken since she learned that Gus was dead. Clara immediately offered Dish a job. It was a hard winter, and they were always behind. The colts would start coming soon, and they would be farther behind. So, of course, it was only sensible to hire another man. But July hated it. He had grown used to working with Clara and Cholo, and he had a hard time adjusting to Dish. Part of it was that Dish was twice as competent with horses as he was himself. And everyone immediately recognized Dish's value. Clara was soon asking Dish to do things with the horses that she had once let July do. July was more and more left with the kind of chores that a boy could handle. To make matters worse, Dish Boget was standoffish and made no attempt to make friends with him. Dish knew many card games and could even play charades, so he was a great hit with the girls. Many a night, through the long winter, July sat against a wall, feeling left out, while Clara, Dish, and the girls played games at the big kitchen table. Dish tried every way he could to draw Lorena into some of the games, but the most Lorena would do was sit in the room. She sat silently, not watching, while July sat just as silently. He could not help but wish that Dish Boget had got lost in Wyoming or had somehow gone on to Texas. Hardly a day passed without him seeing what he thought were signs that Clara was taken with the man. Sooner or later, when Dish gave up on Lorena, he would be bound to notice. July felt helpless. There was nothing he could do about it. Sometimes he sat near Lorena, feeling that he had more in common with her than with anyone else at the ranch. She loved a dead man, and he a woman who hardly noticed him. But whatever they had in common didn't cause Lorena to so much as look his way. Lorena looked more beautiful than ever, but it was a grave beauty since the news of the death had come. Only the young girl, Betsy, who loved Lorena completely, could occasionally bring a spark of life to her eyes. If Betsy was ill, Lorena nursed her tirelessly, taking her into her own bed and singing to her. They read stories together, Betsy doing the reading. Lorena could only piece out a few words. The sisters planned to teach her reading, but knew it would have to wait until she felt better.
Even Sally, usually so jealous of any attention her sister got, respected the fact that Betsy and Lorena were especially close. She would let off teasing Betsy if Lorena looked at her in a certain way. Clara felt no terrible stab of grief when the news of Gus's death came. The years had kept them too separate. It had been a tremendous joy to see him when he visited, to realize that he still loved her, and that she still enjoyed him. She liked his tolerance and his humor, and felt an amused pride in the thought that he still put her above other women, despite all the years since they had first courted. Often she sat on her upper porch at night, wrapped in Bob's huge coat. She liked the bitter cold, a cold that seemed to dim the stars. Reflecting, she decided that there had been something in what she and Gus had felt that needed separation. At close quarters, she felt that she would have struggled bitterly with him. Even during his brief visit, she felt the struggle might start, and if it did start, gentler souls such as July and Lorena might have been destroyed. In the dark nights on the ice-encrusted porch, she occasionally felt a cold tear on her cheek. In Gus, she had lost her ultimate ally, and felt that much more alone. But she had none of the tired despair she had felt when her children died. Now there was July Johnson, a man whose love was nearly mute. Not only was he inept where feelings were concerned, he was also a dolt with horses. Loving horses as she did, Clara was hard put to know why she could even consider settling in with a man who was no better with them than Bob had been. Of course, the settling-in process was hardly complete, and Clara was in no hurry that it should be. Closer relations would probably only increase her impatience with him. It amused her that he was so jealous of Dish, who, though friendly, companionable, and an excellent hand, was not interested in her at all. His love for Lorena leaped out of every look he cast in her direction, although not one of them penetrated Lorena's iron grief. Clara herself didn't try to touch or change Lorena's grief. It was like Martin's fever. Either it would kill her, or it wouldn't. Clara would not have been surprised by a gunshot if it had come from Lorena's room. She knew the girl felt what she had felt when her boys died. Unrelievable grief. In those times, the well-meaning efforts of Bob or the neighbors to cheer her up had merely affronted her. She hadn't wanted to live, particularly not cheerfully. Kindly people told her that the living must live. "I don't, if my boys can't," she wanted to say to them. Yet the kindly people were right. She came slowly back to enjoyment, and one day would even find herself making a cake again and eating it with relish. Watching Lorena as she sat blank with grief every day, scarcely stirring unless Betsy urged her to, Clara felt helpless. Lorena would either live or die, and Clara felt it might be die. Lorena's only tie to life was Betsy. She didn't care for sweets or men or horses. Her only experience with happiness had been Gus. The handsome young cowboy who sent her countless looks of love meant nothing to her. Pleasure had no hold on Lorena. She had known little of it, and Clara didn't count on its drawing her back to life. The young cowboy would be doomed to find his love blocked by Gus in death, even as it had been in life. Betsy had a better chance of saving Lorena than Dish. Betsy worried about her constantly and tried to get her mother to do something. "I can't make Mr. McCrae live again, which is all she wants," Clara said. "What do you think I can do?" "Make her not so sad," Betsy pleaded. "Nobody can do that," Clara said. "I can't even make you not sad when you're sad." Yet one day she did try. She came upon Lori standing in the hall, her hair uncombed. She had the look of a beaten dog. Clara stopped and hugged her, as suddenly as she had hugged July Johnson. In him, her hug had stirred a fever of hope. In Lorena, it stirred nothing. "I guess you wish you'd gone with him," Clara said. "It would have given you a little more time." Lorena looked surprised. It was the one thing she had been thinking since the news came.
I should have, she said.
No, Clara said. You would have had a little more time, I grant you. But now you'd be stuck in Montana with a bunch of men who don't care that you loved Gus. They'd want you to love them. Dish wants it so much that he rode you through the blizzards. The thought of Dish merely made Lorena feel cold.
He wasted his time, she said.
I know that, but don't expect him to realize it, Clara said.
He bought me once, when I was a whore, Lorena said,
surprised at the word on her tongue. She had never used it before. And Gus didn't, Clara said. Lorena was silent. Of course Gus had. She wondered if Clara would ask her to leave, knowing what she had been.
Dish loved you and took the only way he had to get your attention, Clara said.
He didn't get my attention, Lorena said. He didn't get anything.
And Gus did the same and got everything, Clara said.
Gus was lucky and Dish isn't.
I ain't either, Lorena said.
Clara offered no advice. A few days later, when she was sewing, Lorena came and stood in front of her. She looked no better.
Why did you ask me to stay? When it was you Gus loved, she asked.
Why didn't you ask him to stay? If you had, he'd be alive.
Clara shook her head.
He loved us both, she said. But Gus would never miss an adventure. Not for you or me or any other woman. No one could have kept him home. He was a rake and a rambler, though you'd have kept him longer than I could have.
Lorena didn't believe it. She remembered how often Gus had talked of Clara. Of course it no longer mattered. Nothing like that mattered anymore, and yet she couldn't keep her mind from turning to it.
It ain't so, she said. She had used her voice so little that it sounded weak.
It is so, Clara said. You are more beautiful and less bossy. When I told Gus I was marrying Bob all those years ago, he looked relieved. He tried to act disappointed, but he was relieved. I never forgot it. And he had proposed to me 30 times at least, but he saw it would be a struggle if he won me, and he didn't want it.
Clara was silent for a moment, looking into the other woman's eyes.
Bob was too dumb to realize there'd be a struggle, Clara said. Half the time he didn't notice it even when he was in it. So mainly I had to struggle with myself.
It's been lonely, she added. She thought the conversation a good sign. Maybe Laurie was going to come out of it, but it was the last conversation they had for months. Lorena lived through the winter in silence, only speaking to Betsy, who remained as loyal as ever. Dish Boget remained loyal, too. Although Lorena gave him no encouragement, he spent more and more time playing cards with Sally, whose bright, girlish chatter he had come to like. Every day he tried his best with Lorena, but he had begun to feel hopeless. She would not even speak to him, no matter how sweetly he asked. She met everything he said with silence, the same silence she had had in Lonesome Dove, only deeper. He told himself that if the situation didn't improve by the spring, he would go to Texas and try to forget her. Yet when spring came, Dish told Clara he would be glad to stay and help her with the colts.
Chapter 100.
It came to Rankle Call that Gus had left his half of the cattle herd to the woman. The woman was down in Nebraska. She was not there helping. Of course, if she had been there helping, there would have been trouble, but that didn't lessen the aggravation of what Gus had done. He could simply have given her money. He had money. As it was, every time Call sold a bunch of stock to the army, he had to put aside half the money for a woman he had never approved of, who might, for all any of them knew, have already forgotten Gus and married someone else, or even gone back to being a whore. Still, Call had halved the money.
However aggravating it was, Gus had meant it, and he would do it. Though when he went back with the body, he planned to see if he could at least buy her out. He didn't like the thought of being in partnership with a woman, much less a whore, although he conceded that she might have reformed. He lived in the tent all winter, keeping the men working but taking little interest in the result. Sometimes he hunted, taking the hell bitch and riding off onto the plains. He always killed game but was not much interested in the hunt. He went because he no longer felt comfortable around the men. The Indians had not bothered them, and the men did well enough by themselves. Soupy Jones had assumed the top-hand role once Dish left, and flourished in it. The other men did well, too, although there was some grumbling and many small disputes. Hugh Auld and Poe Campo became friends and often tramped off together for a day or two so Hugh could show Poe Campo some pond where there were still beaver or some other interesting place he knew about. Lippy, star for music, played the accordion and spent nearly the whole winter trying to make a fiddle from a shoebox. The instrument yielded a powerful screeching sound, but none of the cowboys were ready to admit that the sound was music. At Christmas, hungering for pork, they killed Gus's pigs. The most surprising development was that Jasper Fant learned to cook. He took it up mainly out of boredom, but tutored by Poe Campo, his progress was so rapid that when Poe Campo went off with old Hugh, the cuisine didn't suffer. In the early spring, while the weather was still chancy, 15 horses disappeared one night. It was only by luck that the theft was discovered, for in such a place, at such a time, horse thieves were the last thing they were expecting. Call had taken the precaution of going with old Hugh to two or three of the nearest Indian camps to meet the chiefs and do the usual diplomacy, in the hope of preventing the sort of surprise encounter that had proven deadly for Gus. The visits made him sad, for the Indians were not belligerent, and it was apparent that Gus had merely struck the wrong bunch at the wrong time, in the wrong manner. It was a depressing irony, for Gus had always been the one to preach diplomacy with the red man, and over the years had engaged in many councils that Call himself thought pointless. Gus had talked to many a warrior that Call would merely have shot, and yet had got killed in a place where most of the Indians were happy to talk, particularly to a man who owned an endless supply of beef. But Call noticed on the visits that, in the main, the Indians had better horses than he did. And he had even arranged a trade with the Blackfeet, 50 beeves for 10 horses. The negotiations had required old Hugh to talk for 2 days and had left him hoarse. Thus, when the Spettle Boy came in to report the horses gone, Call was surprised. Where would a horse thief come from, and where would he go? Still, the fact was a fact. The horses were gone. Call took P, Newt, Needle Nelson, and old Hugh, and went in pursuit. He soon ruled out Indians, for the thieves were traveling too slow, and had even stopped a camp not 30 miles from their headquarters, which Indians with stolen horses would have never been foolish enough to do. It was soon plain that they were only chasing 2 men. They crossed into Canada on the 2nd day and caught the thieves on the 3rd, surprising them at breakfast. They were a shaky old man with a dirty gray beard and a strapping boy about Newt's age. The old man had a single-shot buffalo gun and the boy a cap-and-ball pistol. The boy was cooking venison, and the old man propped against the saddle, muttering over a Bible, when Call walked in with his pistol drawn. The boy, though big as an ox, began to tremble when he saw the 5 men with guns. "I told you, Pa," he said. "Now we're caught." The old man, who had a jug beside his saddle, was clearly drunk, and seemed scarcely conscious of what was occurring. "Why, I'm a minister of the Lord," he said. "Don't point your darn guns at me. We're just having breakfast. This is my boy, Tom." Call disarmed the 2, which only took a second. The 15 horses were grazing in plain sight, not 100 yards from the camp. "We didn't know they were your horses," the boy said, quivering with fright. We thought they were Indian horses. They're all branded, Call said. You could see that unless you're blind. Not blind and not sinners either, the old man said, getting to his feet. He was so drunk he couldn't walk straight. Well, you're horse thieves. That's a sin in my book, Call said. Where do you people come from? From God, man, the old fellow said. Where on earth, I meant, Call said, feeling weary. He wondered what had possessed a minister and a boy to run off with their horses, each plainly branded. It struck him as a stupid and pointless crime, for they were driving the horses north, and there were no towns and no ranches. It was clear the two were poor, and the old man out of his head. Call could tell the hands were glum at the prospect of hanging such a pair, and he himself didn't relish it, but they were horse thieves, and he felt he had no choice. His own distaste for the prospect caused him to make a mistake. He didn't immediately tie the old man, who seemed so weak he could hardly stand. He was not too weak, though, to snatch up a hatchet and strike a blow at Needle that would have killed him had not Needle jerked back. As it was, the blade of the hatchet tore a bad cut in his arm. Call shot the old man before he could strike again. The boy took off running across the open prairie. He was easily caught, of course, but by the time he was tied and led back, the old man was dead. The boy sat down in the thin snow and wept. He was all right until Ma died and Sister died, he said. We were in a wagon train. Then he just went daft and said we had to go off by ourselves. I didn't want to.
I wish he hadn't taken our horses, Carl said.
The boy was trembling and crying. Don't hang me, mister. I never stole in my life. I told him to leave them horses, but he said they were horses the Indians had already stole. I'll work for you. I can blacksmith. I worked 2 years at a forge back in Missouri before we left.
Call knew there was not a decent tree in miles. It would be a hardship on them to ride along with the boy for a day in order to hang him. Besides, they needed a blacksmith. As for the boy's story, maybe it was true and maybe it wasn't. The old man had appeared to be mad, but Call had seen many thieves act that way in hopes that it would save them.
Pa said he'd shoot me if I didn't help, the boy said.
Call didn't believe him. He had been about to cut the boy loose, but he didn't. He put him on one of the stolen horses and they started back. Newt felt sick at the thought of what would happen. He didn't want to see another person hang.
You ask him, he said to P.
Ask him what? P said.
Not to hang him.
He'll hang him. He hung Jake, didn't he?
His pa made him do it, Newt said.
Maybe. Maybe he's just a darn horse thief. When they came to a good tree, Call rode on, all the way to the Hat Creek headquarters. Once there, he cut the boy loose. You can work, he said. For 10 days, the big boy was the friendliest person in the outfit. He shoed all the horses, cut wood, did every chore he was asked to do, and some that he wasn't. He chattered constantly and tried his best to be friendly, and yet no one really liked him. Even Newt didn't really like him. Tom stood too close to him when he talked, and he talked all the time. His large face was always sweaty, even on the coldest days. Even Pocampo didn't like him, and gave him food grudgingly. Then, before dawn one morning, Call caught Big Tom, as they called him, saddling a horse and preparing to ride off. He had 4 of the men's wallets on him, stolen so smoothly that none of the men had even missed them. He had also taken the best saddle in the outfit, which belonged to Bert Borum. Call had been expecting the move for 2 or 3 days, and had made P.I. help him watch. Big Tom tried to make a dash for it, and Call shot him off his horse. Cowboys ran out of their house in their long johns at the shot. Even wounded, the boy proved full of fight.
Call had to wrap him with the barrel of his Henry before he could be tied. This time he was summarily hung, though he wept again and begged for mercy. "It's wasted on horse thieves," Call said, before kicking the boy's horse out from under him. None of the men said a word. "Should have hung him in the first place, although he did shoe them horses," P.I. commented later. Call had begun to think of Gus and the promise he had made. It would soon be spring, and he would have to be going if he were to keep the promise, which of course he must. Yet the ranch had barely been started, and it was hard to know who to leave in command. The question had been in his mind all winter. There seemed to be no grave danger from Indians or anything else. Who would best keep things going? Soupy was excellent when set a task, but had no initiative and was unused to planning. The men were all independent to a fault and constantly on the verge of fist fights because they fancied that someone had attempted to put himself above them in some way. P.I. was clearly the senior man, but P.I. had contentedly taken orders for 30 years. To expect him to suddenly start giving them was to expect the impossible. Call thought often of Newt. He watched him with increasing pride all winter. The boy was the only one left in the crew whom he enjoyed being with. The boy's skill and persistence with horses pleased him. He knew it would be chancy to leave a 17-year-old boy in charge of a group of grown men, yet he himself had led men at that age, and that had been in rougher times. He liked the way the boy went about his work without complaint. He had filled out physically during the year and could work all day energetically and accomplish more than most of the men. Once, watching the boy cross a corral after having worked with one of the Mustangs, P.I. said innocently, "Why, Cap'n, little Newt walks just like you." Call flinched, but P.I. didn't notice. P.I. was no noticer, as Augustus had often said. That night, sitting in Will Barger's little tent, Call remembered the remark. He also remembered Gus's efforts to talk to him about the boy. With Gus pressing him, it was his nature to resist, but with Gus gone, he didn't find it so distasteful to consider that the boy was his son. He had certainly gone to his mother, hateful as the memory was. Maggie, of course, had not been hateful. It was the strange need she induced in him that he disliked to remember. He started taking the boy with him on every trip he made to the forts, not merely to familiarize him with the country, but to let him participate in the selling and trading. Once, as a test, he sent P and the boy and the Raineys to Fort Benton with a sizable bunch of cattle, stipulating that the boy was to handle the details of the sale and bring home the money. Newt did well as he himself could have done. He delivered the cattle safely and sold them for a fair amount and brought the money home. It didn't sit well with Soupy Jones that Newt was being given such authority. It seemed to Soupy that he should have taken the cattle and possibly received a commission in his capacity as top hand. Soupy was rude to Newt from time to time, and Newt ignored him as best he could. Call did nothing, but 2 weeks later he let it be known that he was preparing to send the boy to the fort again, at which point Soupy boiled over. He took it as a slight and said that he would draw his wages and go if that was how things were going to be. Call promptly paid him his wages, much to Soupy's astonishment. He had never imagined such an outcome. "Why, Cap'n, I don't want to leave," he said plaintively. "I got nothing to go to back down south." "Then give me back the money and behave yourself," Call said. "I decide who'll do what around here."
"I know, Captain," Soupy said.
He was aware that he had chosen a bad moment to make his scene, right after breakfast, with many of the hands standing around. "If you have other complaints, I'm listening," Call said. "You seem to be mad at Newt." The words made the hair stand up on the back of Newt's neck. It was the first time he could ever remember the captain having spoken his name. Well, no, I ain't, Soupy said. He's a fair hand, but it don't seem right a fair hand should be put over a top hand unless there's a reason.
He's young, needs the training. You don't. That's the reason, Kolf said. If I tell you to take orders from him, you will, or else leave. They'll be my orders at second hand.
Soupy reddened at the disgusting thought of taking orders from a boy. He stuffed his wages in his pocket, planning to leave, but an hour's contemplation caused him to mellow, and he gave Call back the wages. That night, though, he suddenly stuck out a foot and tripped Newt when Newt walked past with a plate full of food. Newt fell on his face, but he rose and flung himself on Soupy in a second, so angry at the insult that he even held his own for a few licks, until Soupy could bring his weight and experience into play, after which Newt got thoroughly pounded, so thoroughly that he was not aware when the fight stopped. He was sitting on the ground, spitting blood, and Soupy had walked away. Call had expected the fight and watched impassively, pleased that the boy had fought so hard. Winning would have been beyond his powers. The battle won Soupy no friends. He had assumed so many airs once Dish left that he had few friends anyway, whereas Newt was popular. Reaction was so unfavorable that a few days later, Soupy drew his wages again and left, taking Bert with him. They had concluded that they could make Texas if they went together. Call was worried for a few weeks about being short-handed, but then three young men that he had seen at the fort decided to quit soldiering and try their hand at ranching. All three were from Kentucky. They were inept at first, but industrious. Then two genuine cowboys showed up, lured all the way north from Miles City by the news that there was a ranch on the milk. They had given up cowboying for mule skinning the year before and concluded that they had made a bad mistake. Then a tall boy named Jim wandered in alone. He had been with a wagon train but had lost interest in getting to Oregon. Soon, instead of being short-handed, Call found that he had almost more men than he needed. He decided to start the branding early. Several hundred calves had been born since they left Texas. Many were yearlings, and a struggle to brand. A few of the men questioned the necessity, since they were the only cattle outfit in the territory, but Call knew that would soon change. Others would come. The roundup took 10 days. The cattle had spread themselves wide over the range between the milk and the Missouri in their foraging during the winter. Then the branding took a week. At first the men enjoyed the activity, competing with one another to see who could throw the largest animal the quickest. There was also much disagreement over who should get to rope and who should work on foot. Newt improved so rapidly as a roper that he was soon sharing the task with Needle Nelson, the only one of the original crew skilled with a lariat. With the branding ended and the spring grass spiking through the thin May snows, Call knew the time had come for him to fulfill his promise to his old friend. It was awkward, indeed. It seemed absurd to have to tote a 6 months old corpse to Texas, but there it was. Yet May wore on and June approached, and still he had not gone. The snows had melted all down the plains, he imagined, and yet something held him. It wasn't work. There was plenty of men to do the work. They had even had to turn away 3 or 4 men who came looking to hire on. Many times Call spent much of the afternoon watching Newt work with the new batch of horses they had bought on a recent trip to the fort. It was work he himself had never been particularly good at. He had always lacked the patience. He let the boy alone and never made suggestions. He liked to watch the boy with the horses. It had become a keen pleasure. If a cowboy came over and tried to talk to him while he was watching, he usually simply ignored the man until he went away. He wanted to watch the boy and not be bothered. It could only be for a few days, he knew. It was a long piece to Texas and back. Sometimes he wondered if he would even come back. The ranch was started, and the dangers so far had been less than he feared. He felt sometimes that he had no more to do. He felt much older than anyone he knew. Gus had seemed young even when he was dying, and yet Carl felt old. His interest in work had not returned. It was only when he was watching the boy with the horses that he felt himself. In those hours he would lose himself in memory of other times, of other men who had lived with horses, who had broken them, ridden them, died on them. He felt proud of the boy, and with it, anguish that their beginnings had been as they had. It could not be changed, though. He thought he might speak of it sometime, and Gus had wanted him to, and yet he said nothing. He couldn't. If he happened to be alone with a boy, his words went away. At the thought of speaking about it, a tightness came into his throat, as if a hand had seized it. Anyway, what could a few words change? They couldn't change the years. Newt was puzzled at first when the captain began watching him with the horses. At first he was nervous. He felt the captain might be watching because he was doing something that needed correcting. But the afternoons passed, and the captain merely watched, sometimes sitting there for hours, even if it turned wet or squally. Newt came to expect him. He came to feel that the captain enjoyed watching, because of the way the captain had been behaving, giving him more and more of the responsibility for the work. Newt came to feel that Mr. Gus might have been right. The captain might be his father. On some afternoons, with the captain there by the corrals watching, he felt almost sure of it, and began to expect that the captain would tell him soon. He began to listen, waiting to be told, his hope always growing. Even when the captain didn't speak, Newt still felt proud when he saw him come to watch him work. For 2 weeks through the spring evenings, Newt was very happy. He had never expected to share such a time with the captain. And he hoped the captain would speak to him soon and explain all that had puzzled him for so long. One night, toward the end of May, Carl couldn't sleep. He sat in front of the tent all night, thinking of the boy and Gus and the trip he had to make. That morning, after breakfast, he called Newt aside. For a moment, he couldn't speak. The hand had seized his throat again. The boy stood waiting, not impatient. Carl was annoyed with himself for his strange behavior, and he eventually found his voice. "I got to take Gus back," he said. "I guess I'll be gone a year." "You'll have to be the range boss. P will help you. The rest are mostly reliable, though I think that Irishman is homesick and might go home." Newt didn't know what to say. He looked at the captain. "The woman gets half the money when you sell the stock," Carl said. "It was Gus's request. You can bank it for her in Miles City. I'll tell her it's there when I see her." Newt could hardly believe he would be made boss over the men. He expected more orders, but the captain turned away. Later in the morning, he and P.I. and Needle were riding the banks of the milk, seeing if any cattle were bogged. They were always bogging. Getting them out was hard, muddy work, but it had to be done. If it rained, the river might rise in the night and drown the bogged animals. The days were cold and blowy. Newt had to wade out into the mud 3 times to lift the hind ends of the bogged yearlings, while Needle roped the animals by the head and drug them out. Newt scraped the mud off his legs as best he could, put his pants back on, and was getting ready to turn back toward headquarters when he saw the captain riding toward them. He was riding the Hell Bitch and leading Greasy, the big mule that had come with him all the way from Texas, and a rangy dun named Jerry, the mount he preferred after the Hell Bitch. Augustus's old sign was tied to the pack mule. "I guess the captain's going," P.I. said. "He's taking old Greasy and an extra horse." Newt felt his spirits sink. He knew the captain had to leave, and yet he hoped he wouldn't, not for another few days anyway. Carl rode up to the 3 men, dismounted, and to everyone's surprise, unsaddled the Hell Bitch and put the saddle on Jerry. Then he led the Hell Bitch over to where Newt stood. "See how your saddle fits her," Carl said. Newt was so surprised he could only look at the captain in silence. He thought he must have misunderstood. No one but the captain had ridden the mare since the Hat Creek outfit had acquired her.
"Do what?" he finally asked.
"Put your saddle on her," Call said. He felt tired and was finding it difficult to speak. He felt at any moment he might choke.
"I doubt she'd like it," Newt said, looking at the mare, who pointed her ears at him as if she knew what had been said.
But the captain didn't take back the order, so he unsaddled the little sorrel he had been riding, the one Clara had given him, and carried his saddle over to the mare. Call held the bridle while Newt saddled her. Then he handed Newt the reins and went over and took his big Henry out of its scabbard. He removed the Winchester from the boy's saddle and stuck the Henry in his saddle scabbard. It wasn't a perfect fit, but it would do.
"You'll need it for them big bears," he said.
When he turned back to look at the boy, the choking feeling almost overcame him. He decided he would tell the boy he was his son, as Gus had wanted him to. He thought they would ride away a little distance so they could speak in private. And yet when he looked at Newt, standing there in the cold wind, with Canada behind him, Carl found he couldn't speak at all. It was as if his whole life had suddenly lodged in his throat, a raw bite he could neither spit out nor swallow. He had once seen a ranger choke to death on a tough bite of buffalo meat, and he felt that he was choking too, choking on himself. He felt he had failed in all he had tried to be. The good boy standing there was evidence of it. The shame he felt was so strong it stopped the words in his throat. Night after night, sitting in front of Will Barger's tent, he had struggled with thoughts so bitter that he had not even felt the Montana cold. All his life he had preached honesty to his men and had summarily discharged those who were not capable of it, though they had mostly only lied about duties neglected or orders sloppily executed. He himself was far worse, for he had been dishonest about his own son, who stood not 10 feet away, holding the reins of the hell bitch. Call thought he might yet say it, even if the men were there to hear. He trembled from the effort, and his trembling and the look on his face caused great consternation in P.I., who had never known the captain to be at a loss for words. The captain would ride up and give an order, and that was that. But now he merely stood looking at Newt, a jerking in his throat. Looking at the captain, Newt began to feel sadder than he had ever felt in his life. "Just go on," he wanted to say. "Go on if it's that hard." He didn't want the captain to go on, of course. He felt too young. He didn't want to be left with it all. He felt he couldn't bear what was happening. It was so surprising. 5 minutes before, he had been pulling a yearling out of the bog. Now the captain had given him his horse and his gun and stood with a look of suffering on his face. Even Sean O'Brien, dying of a dozen snake bites, had not shown so much pain. "Go on, then," Newt thought. "Just let it be. It's been this way always. Let it be, Captain." Call walked a few steps to the boy and squeezed his arm so hard that Newt thought his fingers had pinched the bone. Then he turned and tried to mount the dun. He had to try for the stirrup 3 times before he could mount. He wished he had died on the mussel shell with Gus. It would have been easier than knowing he could not be honest. His own son stood there. Surely it was true. After doubting it for years, his own mind told him over and over that it was true. And yet he couldn't call him a son. His honesty was lost, had long been lost, and he only wanted to leave. When he mounted, the feeling loosened a bit, and he fell back into the habit he had vowed to discard, the habit of leading.
"There's 2 heifers bogged yet," he said. "They're 1/2 mile downstream. You better go get 'em."
Then he rode over and shook P.I.'s hand. P.I. was so astonished he couldn't close his mouth. Gus had never shaken his hand until the last minute, and now the captain was shaking it too. Help Newt, Carl said. He'll need a steady man. And you qualify if anybody ever did. He raised his hand to Needle Nelson and turned his horse. So long, boys, he said. But he looked again at Newt. The boy looked so lonesome that he was reminded of his own father, who had never been comfortable with people. His father had fallen drunk out of a barn loft in Mississippi and broken his neck. Carl remembered the watch that had been passed on to him, an old pocket watch with a thin gold case. He had carried it since he was a boy. He raised up in his stirrups and took it out of his pocket, handed it to Newt. It was my paws, he said, and turned and left. Darn, Newt, P.I. said, more astonished than he had ever been in his life. He gave you his horse and his gun and that watch. He acts like you're his kin. No, I ain't kin to nobody in this world, Newt said bitterly. I don't want to be. I won't be. Despair in his heart, he mounted the hell bitch as if he had ridden her for years and turned downstream. He felt he never wanted to hope for anything again, and yet no more than a minute later, the strange hope struck him that the captain might have turned back. He might have forgotten something, perhaps an order he had meant to give. Even that he would have welcomed. It felt so lonely to think of the captain being gone. But when he turned to look, the captain was merely a speck on the long plain. He was gone. And things would never be as Newt had hoped. Never. Somehow it had been too hard for the captain, and he had left. P.I. and Needle followed Newt silently. P.I. felt old and frightened. In a few minutes, the whole ground of his life had shifted. And he felt stricken with foreboding. For 30 years, the captain had been there to give orders, and frequently the orders had kept them alive. He had always been with the captain, and yet now he wasn't. He couldn't understand why the captain had given Newt the horse, the gun, and the watch. The business of the axe, and what he had heard when retrieving it, was forgotten. It had puzzled him so long that it had finally just slipped his mind. Well, here we are, he said wearily. I guess we'll just have to do the work. The Texas Bull was standing 100 yards or so away with a small group of cows. When the riders drew near, he began to bellow and paw the earth. It irritated him if he saw several riders together, though he had not charged anyone lately. I'll tell you one thing. I may shoot that bull yet, Needle said. I've put up with that son of a bitch about long enough. The captain may like him, but I don't. Newt heard the talk, but didn't speak. He knew the captain had left him with too much, but he didn't say it. He would have to try and do the work, even if he no longer cared. Feeling that it was pointless, but acting from force of habit, they pulled the 2 stuck heifers from the Milk River mud.
Chapter 101
In Miles City, Call found that the storage of Augustus's remains had been bungled. Something had broken into the shed and knocked the coffin off the barrels. In the doctor's opinion, it had probably been a wolverine, or possibly a cougar. The coffin had splintered, and the varmint had run off with the amputated leg. The mistake wasn't discovered until after a blizzard had passed through, so of course the leg had not been recovered. The look on Call's face when he heard the news was so grim it made the doctor extremely nervous. "We've mostly kept him," he said, avoiding Call's eye. "I had him repacked. He had done lost that leg before he died anyway. It was in the coffin when I left it here," Call said. He didn't care to discuss the matter with the man. Instead, he found the carpenter who had built the coffin in the first place and had him reinforce it with strong planks. The result was a heavy piece of work. By luck, the same day, Call saw a buggy for sale, It was old, but it looked sturdy enough, and he bought it. The next day he had the coffin covered in canvas and lashed to the seat. The buggy hood was in tatters, so he tore it off. Greasy the mule was used to pulling the wagon and hardly noticed the buggy, it was so light. They left Miles City on a morning when it had turned unseasonably cold, so cold that the sun only cast a pale light through the frigid clouds. Call knew it was dangerous to go off with only two animals, but he felt like taking his chances. The weather improved the next day, and he rode for a time beside 100 or so Crow Indians who were traveling south. The Crow were friendly, and their old chief, a dried-up little man with a great appetite for tobacco and talk, tried to get Call to camp with them. They were all interested in the fact that he was traveling with a coffin and asked him many questions about the man inside. "We traveled together," Call said. He did not want to talk about Gus with the old man or anyone. He wanted to get on, but he was cordial and rode with the Crow because he felt that if he were discourteous, some of the young bucks might try to make sport with him further south, when he was out of range of the old chief's protection. Once he struck Wyoming, he rode for 11 days without seeing a soul. The buggy held up well, but Greasy lost flesh from the pace Call kept. The coffin had some bad jolts crossing the gullies near the powder, but the reinforcements held it together. The first people he saw as he approached Nebraska were 5 young Indians who had gotten liquor somewhere. When they saw he was carrying a dead man, they let him alone. Though they were too drunk to hunt successfully and begged him for food, none of them looked to be 18, and their horses were poor. Call started to refuse, but then he reflected that they were just boys. He offered them food if they would give up their liquor, but at that they grew quarrelsome. One drew an old pistol and acted as if he might fire at him, but Call ignored the threat, and they were soon gone. He regretted that he had to take Gus to the women, but felt it was part of his obligation to deliver the notes Gus had written when he was dying. The Platte was so full of ducks and geese that he heard their gabbling all day, though he rode a mile from the river. He thought often of the men he had left up on the milk, and of the boy. He had not expected the parting to go as it had, and could not get his mind off it. For several 100 miles down through Montana and Wyoming, he left them all over again in his mind, day after day. He imagined many times that he had said things that he had not said, and from concentrating on it too much as he traveled down the plains, he began to grow confused. He missed being able to sit at the corrals and watch Newt work with the horses. He wondered if the boy was handling the hell bitch well, and if any more men had left the ranch. Then before he had scarcely reined in at Clara's house, where he found Dish Bogat breaking horses with a young sheriff from Arkansas, the woman began a quarrel with him. She had acquired some small shrubs somehow and was out planting them, bareheaded and in overshoes when he arrived. "So you're doing it, are you, Mr. Call?" Clara said when she saw him. She had a look of scorn in her eyes which puzzled him, since he was merely carrying out the request of the man who had loved her for so long. Of course, Dish had told her that Gus wanted his body taken to Texas. "Well," he asked. "I said I'd do it," Call said. "Gus was crazy, and you're foolish to drag a corpse that far," Clara said bluntly. "Bury him here and go back to your son and your men. They need you. Gus can rest with my boys." Call flinched when she said the word son, as if she had never had a doubt that Newt was his. He himself had once been a man of firm opinion, but now it seemed to him he knew almost nothing, whereas the words Clara flung at him were hard as rocks. "I told him that very thing," Call said. "I told him you'd likely want him here." "I've always kept Gus where I wanted him, Mr. Call," Clara said. "I've kept him in my memory for 16 years. Now we're just talking of burying his body. Take him to the ridge, and I'll have July and Dish get a grave dug." "Well, it wasn't what he asked of me," Call said, avoiding her eyes.
It seems that picnic spot you had in Texas is where he wanted to lay.
Gus was a fine fool, Clara said.
He was foolish for me and any other girl who would have him for a while. Because it was me he thought of while dying is no reason to tote his bones all the way to Texas.